Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is Hudson Owen. He wears many hats, but the most familiar is that of poet. Good morning, Hudson, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Simon. I'm happy to be on your show.
I was digging around in the murky world of the internet, and you seem to have led a pretty interesting life. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, sure. I was born in Buffalo, New York. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. I've lived in several states and spent some time in Canada, mostly Toronto. I've had many jobs in support of my writing. My first full-time jobs were in hospitals. I was an orderly at the hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. I can't think of the name right now. Mass General, it's called, the Massachusetts General, a huge hospital. I worked in many of the operating rooms there, and I also worked later at McLean Mental Hospital in Belmont, in Massachusetts, the same hospital in the film and the book Girl Interrupted. And I've had many, many jobs since then doing all kinds of things.
Your new book, Selected Poems 67 to 07, is a delightful read. You must be very happy to see this in print.
Well, I'm a little surprised. I wasn't actually looking to print a second book myself. When I was looking around for something to do last spring, either to start a new project or to revive an older one, the title of the book popped into my head, Selected Poems 1967 to 2007. And that surprised me because, as I say, I wasn't looking to do that. But I've learned over the years to do what my mind prompts me to do. And I knew that to get it into print in any good time, I would have to do it myself. So I busied myself in the spring starting with that. And it took most of the year, actually, to do it. And it came out okay. It took a lot of work and a lot of proofreading and that sort of thing. It's tough to check your own material. But I'm pleased with the process. Yeah, it's a good idea to have an editor if you're going to do that, but one of my many jobs was as a proofreader professionally, and so that's helped me to actually see what's on the page. So I worked through the mistakes there, and it's pretty good the way it came out.
Mm-hmm. This is your second book. Tell us a little bit about your earlier work, the first book.
The first book is called The Endless Evolving Trilogy of Poem Cycle, and that goes way back. That started in 1973 with a group of poems called The Living Legend of Pisis Really Here, which is kind of playful verse. Fictional characters, what happens to the world when you can't make war anymore, but you still have problems, naturally. It's sort of an answer to John Lennon's Give Peace a Chance ideas. And then I combined it with other writings over the years, and I tried to publish this and was unable to do so. So in 2000, I caught the first wave of print-on-demand publishing on the internet. I wanted to see if I could sell something online, and in addition just to having the book in print. So I got it published with iUniverse, and I was able to get a couple of reviews, online reviews, and sell some books. But I still pursue that book, and I'm still trying to get more serious reviews from professional critics. And so that's still alive. So now I have two books. They're both books of poems.
I'm guessing that in this day and age, everyone has a website. Where can people find you online? Because I'm sure you have links where people can order both books.
Yes, I have a one website at this point. It's in the WordPress galaxy, and the web address is hudowen, H-U-D-O-W-E-N, as one word, at WordPress, as it sounds, wordpress.com. And if you put that in your browser and punch enter, you'll go directly to that website. And there I have poetry. I have essays, which have attracted some comments, and some of my digital artwork. And I put my musical about Americans in Paris in the 1920s there as well. So it's a work in progress, and I'm getting some good hits on it, so I'm hopeful about that.
So clearly poetry is your first love, but you also said you write essays. I understand you've done some acting in your time.
I did do the acting, yes. pardon me. That was mostly the New York part of it was mostly in 1991, 92, thereabouts. It was a short, glorious career, you might say, with a little bit of stage work, and I starred in a music video and some independent film and extra work. And I did that for a while, but I hit a real rough patch, and there was a very hard winter in New York, 91, 92. It snowed about 16 times during the winter. Made it hard to get around. There was ice and whatnot on the streets all the time. And I couldn't get enough paying work to pay the rent. I was doing it as a job, not just to sacrifice for the theater or as a hobby kind of thing. So I wasn't able to keep it up. I didn't get enough paying work. But it was fun while it lasted, and I'm glad I did it.
It certainly sounds like you've had an incredibly wide variety of jobs in your time. Maybe we could get you to read one of the poems from your book. I like to Dylan Thomas.
Okay, I've written a number of poems to people either living or dead. Most of my mentors when I started out were dead. Their work is not dead, but they were no longer around to speak to. And I think in a way, it's a way of reaching out to people dead or alive to get, in a way, to get strength or to build an association with. Maybe that sounds a little fishy, I don't know. But anyway, I'm part Welsh, and I've always enjoyed and admired the work of Dylan Thomas. I read his biography, and of course, I have his book of selected poems. I don't know when I wrote this. It goes back quite a ways. But anyway, here we go, to Dylan Thomas. Thumping scruffy pug mark, Welsh metaphor. Loop power through our cochlea with heron's beaks. Place pennies in our fuses. Play lead guitar. Though we might not protest, we'd be distressed if you took up photography and only gave us telephoto moons, gravura rocks, silhouettes not men tackled with clouds who kneel to sunset nets, and time-lapse weather would turn around. Prince of Apple Towns, reluctant mellow gorge, you mentioned wagons. They did have cars back then. Today, dial-a-poems. Would you laugh? You joked but also held head high before the words bards might have known, asleep beneath the bouncing hills, so still the stillness might disturb. But who can see as they in their time? Who rides down rivers of windfall light? Astronomers have nets to fish in stars. No, poets have their grief and fun. Ah, poets have their ways. Your eyes hung out on stalks like snails, you said. And so you saw, glad and aghast, the dipping lights of a dumbfounded town, the flashing lights of a veering world, a country scene wherever you went, among the lords of fact and anxious ladies. And there was always comfort and cheer, that voice and the light in the barroom glass, golden in the mercy of their means, a while. Green and golden you were and are, huntsmen and herdsmen of songs play sounds, wondering which way is the owl in the wood, certain of the splash of pebbles and streams, words tossed greatly as coins, English and song.
Thanks for reading that. It's a very interesting poem. Tell us a little bit about it, a little more about it.
Excuse me. Well, I'm in the first couple lines here, I'm saying, give us power, give us strength, loop power through our cochlea. That's part of the inner ear,
right,
with Heron speaks, which is part of his world of animals and nature. Place pennies in our fuses, play lead guitar. In other words, we're living in a different age today. We're living more in the age of Bob Dylan. So we need a little bit of help from a star of a slightly different era, I'm saying. And I'm bringing in some of his imagery of talking about telephoto moons and silhouettes, not men tackled with clouds who kneel to sunset nets. That's his language, his phraseology. So these are things that he's not, that we live with today. So I'm going back sort of to the simple idea of the poet, the Prince of Apple Towns. Again, that's from Fern Hill, one of his famous poems. And he, when I say mellow gorge, of course I'm referring to his voice, which was one of the great speaking voices of the 20th century. And you can hear him online if you go, if you search for Dylan Thomas. There's a website devoted to him and other websites that have voice recordings, and I would urge you to do that, to listen to him read. He's just he's wonderful in that. And he told jokes when he did a reading. He would start like a modern entertainer, a comedian would, and he would tell a few jokes. And then he would say, okay, that was a jam, now here's the pill. And the pill would be his poems, and he would read the poems. Of course, his audience was there to hear the poems and not just to take the jokes, but that's the way he did things. And so I'm bringing up something of his world, the bouncing hills, and the seriousness, the stillness of the sleeping bards, something, the world that he was connected to. He's like a spiritual link to that ancient ancestral past. And then there's, kind of chumminess with poets have their grief and fun, poets have their ways. And he wrote in one of his writings about himself, when he was young, his eyes hung out on stalks like snails. In other words, he was very eager in the world. He was excited. Everything was new, and he had bug eyes, you might say. But he also was very prescient, and he understood very well the limitations of his life and the world that he came from, the dumbfounded town. That's language from Under Milkwood, his play sort of Welsh life.
Right.
So that brings us down pretty much to the end here. But he lives. He lives. He's greened and golden. You were and are, and you're always with us with your English and your song.
Right. Well, one observation that I have from reading selected poems is that you vary your style a great deal. You don't stick with one style of poetry. Now, I know that the book's not in a strict chronological order, so I can't tell if your style has changed or evolved over time, or are you the kind of writer that just picks the style to suit the subject matter?
I gave myself at the beginning of my writing the freedom to write anything that my mind was trying to write. In other words, if my mind was trying to write something in a loose, free verse sort of style, I said, okay, let's do that. If my mind was working in a tighter verse form, like a quatrain, an A-B-A-B kind of rhyme scheme, I said, okay, I'll go with that. So in writing a particular poem, I sort of listen to my head. I feel an urge. So what is this urge to do? Well, after I practiced a bit, and I read a great deal of poetry, all kinds of things, foreign poets in English, and thousands of poems. So after a while, I could tell pretty much where this impulse wanted to go. And so I would start the poem, whatever it was. It might be a 5-line stanza, 7-line stanza. It might be rhyme. It might be rhyme with free verse. I've done that. That's called occasional rhyme. And over the years, I write less poetry, fewer poems. I suppose I've written more free verse in later years. But one poem in this book toward the end, where are we here? I'm looking for it. Evening in America. Now that I wrote a couple years ago. So that's verse, that's quatrains. So I still write that, and that runs basic through everything. So it's hard to say that I've evolved, other than that I don't write a whole lot of poetry anymore. I've evolved in that direction.
Right. From reading the introduction, it's clear that poetry is not a way to get rich quick. You comment about making a whopping $7 for doing one particular reading. But it sounded like an interesting story. Perhaps you could tell our listeners about it.
Well, I live in Brooklyn and have lived in Brooklyn, since 1976. And I used to live in Park Slope, which was well known. It's been filmed many times. The Chosen, I believe, was filmed in Park Slope. Anyway, the literati live there. It's famous place on the literary map, filled with writers today. And it's good distance, a good way to get around. So there was this bar way out on 7th, 8th Avenue, 10, 15 blocks away. I can't remember the name of the bar. But in the 80s, early 90s, they were doing poetry readings once a night or something like that. So I went to this bar with a couple of female friends to buoy my spirits and to have somebody that I knew in the audience anyway. And it was a variety of acts. It wasn't all poetry. Anyway, we were sitting, three of us, at our little table, I guess, with a beer in hand. And there were some, like, dancers and this and that going on. Some of the professional people, they did a pretty good job. And then this character comes, I guess there was a black box. It was either sitting there or had been pushed in the spotlight, I don't remember. And there are strobe lights and maybe some sound and somebody there with a camcorder. And this guy crawls out of the box and, I don't know, did this and that. And anyway, his big moment was exposing himself to the audience. And his naughty bits, as the Brits would say. And not all too impressive either. I wouldn't rate him high for triple X work. And that was it. And then he was off, and I don't remember what else. Anyway, I did my bit. I read a few poems. I really can't remember what I did. But when the show was over, the fellow who ran the evening there at the bar came over and sat down with me and my friends, and he apologized for this lewd act. He said he hadn't been warned about it in advance, and he gave me my share of the take, I guess, at the bar, or maybe people had bought tickets, I don't remember, and it was $7 and change.
Right.
So that's a bit of Brooklyn for you.
Yeah, it's certainly not something you would expect at a poetry reading.
No, it isn't.
If
you're interested, I had another kind of funny experience reading, again with this sort of different variety act on the Upper East Side in the Comedy Club of New York. This, again, is years ago. And that was, they were like hosting what we were doing. And we came on, our little group came on before comedy time, so that audience hadn't arrived yet. And I was the only poet there. And I dressed up, I put on my blue velour jacket and my blue velour bow tie. I very seldom wore that outfit. And I knew these people weren't going to sit for something like To Dylan Thomas. So I just read some short verse, comic kind of material, and I got a polite round of applause. Then I sat down, and I was toward the end of that segment of the show, and then these comedians came up there, and boy, they were heavy hitters. You know, with the grinding out with the sex jokes and this and that, and so it was again a kind of a heavy dose following the lighthearted kind of poet and the act that we put on there. But I was told later that I was the first poet that had ever read there, so that goes on my resume as the first reading at the New York Comedy Club.
There you go. Well, one of the other poems in the book that caught my eye is The Enormous Children. Perhaps you could read that one for us.
Well, let me see. Well, yes, this is, I've written various poems about boomers in my own generation. There's a lot of that material in my first book, The Endless Evolving Trilogy. That's much closer in time to that. But this poem, The Enormous Children, is more recent, and it takes a more jaundiced view of the whole baby boom experience from a more distant perspective. The Enormous Children. Born of a boom in booming times after a booming war, the enormous children popped out, and their first word was more. Their parents, like all good winners, went out and bought the store. The enormous children jumped for joy and cried for more and more. They got Lincoln Logs, Erector sets, Little League, and TV too, and TV dinners and Heartland food, so they grew and grew and grew. Then one day their parents said, "It's time to fight your war." The enormous children jumped up and down and really swore. "Why," their parents sternly asked, "doesn't everyone have a war?" "No," the enormous children shouted, and they up and rocked the store. They took toys off their Christmas list and gave up apple pie. They knocked the nuclear family and sang while they were high. As the enormous children said, and children are always right, it was not business as usual when you saw things in their light. Well, debaters will ever debate the Beatles and their songs, if Sally, Dick, and Spot were right, if the rights outweighed the wrongs. Enormous children grew and grew, and they do so to this day. Yes, some have turned into grown-ups. Some are merely touched with gray.
Yes, you're right. it is a rather jaundiced look at the baby boomer generation. I'm assuming that the war in question is Vietnam.
That is correct.
I understand you spent some time in Canada. Was that in connection with Vietnam?
Oh, it was, yeah, definitely. Yeah, mm-hmm. I lived there for about 7.5 years, mostly in Toronto.
Right. Tell us a little about the creative process. I've interviewed, I don't know how many musicians, hundreds probably, but I don't often get to interview poet. Now, musicians tend to come up with one line, and that becomes the anchor point for the song. Mm-hmm. Is that the way poetry evolves? Do you start with a single phrase, or do you have sort of a more complete image?
I don't know if it's quite that simple as a line, a musical line. It might be a word or a phrase, or just a feeling, just kind of a cloud in your head of something, and you know it's going to work itself into a poem, and then I just sit down when it's intuitive. It's something you feel inside when I feel I'm ready to write. And then it starts coming out, sometimes very rapidly. And then, I go over it and over it until I've lost interest in it. The poem is alive in as long as it's working in your head somewhere. When you're done with it, when you're, I guess, bored with it, then it stops and then it's finished, whether it's any good or not. But some things have been alive in my head for decades. And I'll change one word maybe in 20 years. But I don't know that it's as simple as music. I think music is more basic, more elemental. I think that one line, that one phrase, that whatever it is, that rhythm, I think that's simpler than words.
Right. It's interesting. I recently interviewed musician Al Stewart, who is probably best known for Year of the Cat. And his take really surprised me. He said, "I hate writing my music down because once it's written, it's cast in stone. It's so much better to still have it evolving in your brain. But once it's down on paper, that's it. It's done. It's over. You know, you just move on to the next project."
Yeah, I understand. I think what he's saying there. Of course, there are all kinds of ways of recording. You know, just it doesn't escape. When you sit down and you improv, you're still recording it. So even though you're not writing it down, it's not escaping entirely into the mists of space. But yeah, I see what he's saying. Once you're looking at the words here, the enormous children born of a boom in booming times, then you can become hypnotized by your own writing, and it's harder to see it as something new and different.
Right. What kind of feedback are you getting from readers about this book?
Very little.
Oh no.
I have some reviews on my website, and I have some reviews of the individual poems rather than the book. The only sort of review of the book is from the poet Annie Finch, who said, "I enjoyed the wit of the poems," and she mentioned a couple of them. The poem that's in the review you published in Blogger News Network, the Vietnam poem, "Epitaph of an American Soldier Killed in a Foreign Adventure." She liked that, and there was.
Oh, I, so did I. It's short, but it says so much. I think it sums up Vietnam very well indeed.
Well, I thank you for your kind words. I wrote that in, I think, freshman year in college. I was 18, 19 or something, and that was all very much going on in the world, and we were all concerned about that one way or the other.
Right. I hate to tell you this, but our time is at an end. And I'm being nagged by my producer to wrap this up.
Okay.
But Hudson, it has been delightful to talk with you, and I do wish you every success in all of your endeavors. And I do hope that everyone will make point of checking out your website, which is hudowen.wordpress.com,
no.
I believe. No?
hudowen@wordpress.com.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry about that. My mistake. Hudson.
Well, I very much enjoyed this half hour with you, Simon. It's the first time I've done a radio interview. I hope it's not the last. But thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. And I will send you the link to the recording as soon as I get it.
Very good. I'll be looking forward to that.
Great. Hudson, it's been delightful. You have yourself a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Okay, this is Simon Barrett signing off for Blogger News on the Radio. Have a great day, everyone. Goodbye.